ChoosingHats.com, dedicated to the explanation and demonstration of presuppositional apologetics in defense of the Christian faith for the glory of God.
Good evening and welcome to Peripatetic. At this very moment, I am in the middle of Ohio, driving down State Highway 24. It's a beautiful night. It's almost midnight. There is a nice half moon in the sky. It's really pretty. I'm driving right toward Indianapolis at the moment. Not really a whole lot else to say other than I just keep shuttling back and forth, doing what I do, driving down the road. Things are fairly quiet on the home front. There's nothing really all that exciting that I can talk about at the moment, other than the subject I wanted to bring up today. I've been asked before what advice that I would have for a young apologist or a new apologist, or even one that's started to master the basics. And by the basics, of course, I'm not talking about all of the world's philosophy and just the list of facts that you can throw at the unbeliever. No, I'm more talking about the study of theology, the study of hermeneutics, the study of the biblical languages, the things more along that line, the things that are going to be more useful as far as a biblical apologetic is concerned, as far as a covenantal apologetic is concerned. Isn't to say that there's no use at all for these evidences or the list of facts. Those are nice to know. But in my experience, knowing those facts without knowing the context for the facts is worse than not knowing any at all, if I can put it that way. Because if all you know, for instance, with a Roman Catholic is the list of when all these dogmas were defined by the infallible magisterium, what use is it to know when it was defined if you don't know why it was defined, if you don't know what the context of the dogma itself coming up in the expression of theologians within the Roman Catholic Church was leading up to that point, what cultural and experiential context there was for that dogma's development. If you don't know, for instance, that although it was defined as a dogma by the Roman Catholic Church, that it is indeed the case that it was defined as a dogma at this date, but remember that the claim of the Roman Catholic Church is that the Church Universal has always believed all these doctrines, on the one hand. But then on the other hand, you're going to have the development hypothesis from Newman that says that these doctrines developed over time. Well, if you don't know all that, how much good is it for you to have a list of all these dates that the dogmas were defined? How much good is that going to do you as far as actually engaging in the apologetic task? But that's more of just a just in the way of an example, because basically what my advice would be to a young apologist, to a new apologist, to a new pastor, when you begin to engage in apologetics, I want you to think about something. In what context are you in now? Where has God placed you? Who is in your life? Who is in your community that you will come into contact with, you will run into on a regular basis? because there is a tendency amongst presuppositionalists, somehow there's been this tradition that's popped up amongst us that presuppositionalism or the covenantal apologetic method is only good against atheism. That is simply not the case. It's not even remotely true. If you look at Van Til's work, yes, he does deal with the general atheism. However, most of his interaction using a transcendental type argument is dealing with the issues of his day and with the other proponents of other methodologies, but on the basis of their undergirding theology. He spends more time dealing transcendentally with Roman Catholics and with Arminianism, I would argue, in his apologetic teaching books, like Defense of the Faith, Christian Apologetics, and such things as that, than he does with pretty much any other group. And that should be revealing to us. If Van Til thought it was important to not only address the theological underpinnings of a group, but do so apologetically, then it should also behoove us to do the same. But not just that, Van Til's other work, his polemic work, dealt with idealism. That was one of his subjects in the volume Christianity and Idealism, with Barthianism. That was the title of another one of his books, Christianity and Barthianism. The thrust of those works was to argue transcendentally against the ideas of Barth and against the ideas of idealism. So obviously I don't think Van Til thought that his methodology was only effective against atheism, or why would he write the books that he did if that was the case? And if the founder of the method didn't think so, why should we? Just on a practical level as well, if everybody and their brother in the presuppositional camp, and I do have to include choosing hats in this too, has a, shall we say, inordinate focus on atheism proper, who's dealing with the Roman Catholics? Who's dealing with the Jehovah's Witnesses? Who's dealing with the Mormons? Who's dealing with the Baha'i? Who's dealing with the Muslims? Who's dealing with all these people? Are we going to leave the apologetic interaction with all these other religious groups in the hands of folks that we all agree aren't theologically capable of forming an appropriate apologetic to these groups? Can an Arminian really have a functional apologetic versus a Roman Catholic? Van Til makes that point with great emphasis in Defense of Faith, that the Arminian really has no basis on which to critique the Roman Catholic theologically, because essentially he accepts most of the same theological tenets, but without certain dogmatically defined doctrines held to by Rome, such as the Marian dogmas or the infallibility of the Roman Pope. But if on most other levels the Arminian essentially agrees with the Roman Catholic on soteriology, on the the nature of man and his will, on the sovereignty of God, on the nature of grace. Is that who we want to be representing Christianity when dealing with Muslims or Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses or Seventh-day Adventists? You know, who is it that has the most capability of dealing with all these groups on a theological level and from a systematic stance? If you've ever read Arminian Systematic, it's quite clear that they really don't have any basis to deal with these groups from their systematic theology. It's far too incoherent. Now, they're going to do so inconsistently. They might do so okay up to a point, but at some point they're going to fall apart. If you've heard William Lane Craig debating Shabir Ali, you know what I'm talking about. Basically, he just gives up original sin. Just says, well, you know, you don't have to hold to that. What? Really? It's just unbelievable. So, if I might exhort you to something, there is a lot of documentation on the web, in lectures, in debates, about how to deal with atheism. There is only one person that I know of who has dealt with all the subjects that I'm speaking of from a presuppositional basis, and that's James White. That there isn't anybody else. I can't think of a single person that has dealt with every single one of those subjects that I've mentioned thus far from a presuppositional basis. That's pretty slim pickings, folks. Now, he's the most prolific debater, like, ever, just about. How many other people do you know has over 100 public moderated debates against that wide variety of folks? It's unbelievable. Now, I take that back. Not every single group. I don't think he's had a debate against the Baha'i. And I don't think he's had a debate against a Seventh-day Adventist. But he's dealt with Oneness Pentecostalism. He's dealt with Jehovah's Witnesses, with Mormons, with Muslims, with Roman Catholics, with Arminians, with just a wide variety of groups, a breathtakingly wide variety of groups. And I really do commend his debates to you. They really are that good. On the other hand, should he be out there by himself? That's mostly what I'm trying to exhort you to. The biggest issue I see is that, yes, it is important for us all to understand how to deal with the stridency and the stridency and volume of modern-day atheism. That is important to know. That's part of being a well-rounded apologist. But if you look at the numbers, atheism, whatever they might claim, is not that large a group. It really is not. How many Roman Catholics are there compared to atheists? How many Muslims are there compared to atheists? How many Jehovah's Witnesses are there compared to atheists? I would submit to you that it might actually be the case that there are as many Jehovah's Witnesses, at least in the United States, as there are self-professed atheists. I don't think I'm too far on a limb saying that. And definitely when we come to, say, the Mormons, I don't think there's even a question of that being the case. So if, you know, you've got it all down pat when it comes to atheism, but you don't know a thing about Mormonism and you live in, say, Utah, or maybe in upstate New York, where good old Joseph Smith got his golden tablets, shall we say? Or if you live in the Midwest, near one of the near where he discovered all the great stuff about the Nephites and Lamanites and burial mounds and mummies and all this wonderful other stuff that is involved with the Mormon apologetic, it might behoove you to know a little bit about Mormonism. If you live in a community that has a whole lot of Muslims, and, you know, there's a college nearby, so there's a whole bunch of atheists, and, you know, you just get on top of that whole atheism deal. If you have, like, 17 times more Muslims in the area than you do atheists, well, it's great that you know how to deal with the atheists, but what about when you have to deal with the Muslims? Let me just encourage you, whatever groups, whatever folks are around you, that's something you need to know. That's something you need to be looking for. I would submit a lot more assiduously than you would for, you know, your college campus where you know there's going to be the atheists. Because on every college campus, there's going to be some atheists, because when you're young, that's like your whole rebellious little teenager phase there. And, you know, that's how you get back at mom and dad for being a nominal Catholic, Protestant, evangelifish, whatever. And you get away from your milk-fed youth group, and you see the real power of atheism, and great. It's great to know how to deal with atheism. But in my experience, the level of argumentation for atheism, on the whole, is going to be a lot less developed, at least as far as what we have to offer to an atheist. The comparison is going to be night and day compared to, say, the Muslims or the Mormons or even a Jehovah's Witness. I mean, let me put it this way. A Jehovah's Witness is going to be a lot more likely to deal with your argumentation in response to them if you are a complete neophyte when it comes to discussing their favorite topics, as they are with your biblical argumentation concerning, let's say, the Trinity, okay? They're going to know a lot more about Christianity than you know about Jehovah's Witnesses. So when it comes to atheism, yes, we've got all this stuff. I mean, Bonson did how many debates? Dr. White has several debates with atheists, with Dan Barker, with Dan Silverman, both of which are very excellent debates, by the way. But just keep something in mind. With the wealth of information that we already have about atheism, if you want to contribute positively to the community of presuppositional apologists, if you want to do something positive for everyone else, as well as for those folks in particular that you are witnessing to and defending the faith against, I would submit to you that you do far more good by dealing with the folks that are near to you, that you're going to meet all the time, and probably won't be atheists. They probably won't be. If you live up in Dearborn, Michigan, I'm sorry, I would not be concentrating on atheism. I really wouldn't. I'd be concentrating on Islam. There's really no reason for you to specialize, let's say, in atheism when you have Muslims all around you. There's a reason that Dr. White started out with Mormonism, because he lives in Arizona. There's a lot of Mormons in Arizona because Utah is right next door. There is a large Mormon community spread all around the state of Utah, including into northern Arizona. And being from Arizona myself, I actually know quite a few Mormons. So think about where you will do the most, where you will have the most value in your study. Are you going to have more value in developing the same arguments that everyone else uses against the same old atheists at the same old places that say the same old things. But in addition, well, let me finish this thought first. When you just wear the same old tread into the carpet, you're going to get into a rut. If all you ever do is walk up and down the same place and everybody's just following each other in a single file line on up and down and up and down and up and down, all talking about the exact same things, that isn't going to help anyone. Now, it's great that you learn that. But in my experience, we need to grow past just dealing with atheism. We need to grow past that. I'm not saying anything bad about people who primarily deal with atheists. If that's their ministry, they've already got into that, they've got large opportunities in doing so, that's great. But let me give you a few examples. I have a friend from the from Dr. White's chat channel. He goes by the handle of Virology. In his local area, there's a fairly large abortion clinic, and they deal with this abortion clinic all the time. They witness at the abortion clinic, the abolished human abortion folks. I believe he's one of the founding members in the original chapter. I'm not positive, but that's the impression that I've gathered. I'm not sure. If I'm wrong, someone please correct me. But he is taking his knowledge of the covenantal apologetic and applying it to dealing with the subject of abortion specifically. That's his specialty. Now, there has been argumentation about abortion before, but how many people actually apply the presuppositional method to the specific subject of abortion in today's culture? When dealing with the subject of homosexuality, how many presuppositional apologists are there dealing with that particular subject? I don't know how many there are. I know Dr. White's dealt with that. In fact, the night that I'm recording this, he just finished a debate up in Montana with a homosexual named Justin Lee. I don't know how the debate went. I haven't heard any news about it yet, but you know, there needs to be more than a voice in the wilderness here and there. There really does. If we're going to be salt and light in this culture, if we're going to make this a public stand, if you want something that rips off the mask, if it's you want something that tears down the fortress walls raised up against the knowledge of God, the presuppositional method is the best and fastest way to do so, the clearest way to do so. I've heard Dr. Brown, who is another frequent debater in the subject of homosexuality, deal with the homosexual argument from a more evidential standpoint. And when you listen to his presentations next to Dr. White's presentations, there's really a night and day difference. It's all well and good to have a vast array of facts at your disposal, but if the debate becomes essentially, I throw these facts, you throw these facts, and we just all assume that they're all neutral facts, and that, you know, they could all be just, you know, I have the facts on my side. No, I have the facts on my side. Well, I have experts over here, and I have experts over there. That's what most of those debates have devolved into. Every debate I've heard with him dealing with the subject has devolved into that. That's not his intention, I'm sure. He has, what I hear, a great book on the subject. I have not read it myself. I do mean to pick it up. But how many voices are there raised against that rather vocal minority movement in the United States? And just as something that might give you further impetus, we don't have long to continue this debate before it's over. You have Douglas Wilson, you have James White. As far as presuppositional apologists dealing with this issue, that's pretty much it, folks. That's it. So if that's all you got, we need to have a little better representation for that. I'm not saying to stop all dealings with atheists. You know, if you run into an atheist, great. But we all have a tendency to go looking for those particular folks that we can beat up on, let's say. And there comes a point where it becomes more about winning the argument than it does about building something of value for the church. And I would submit to you that you're going to build something of more value to the church by working together with folks like James White, with folks like Douglas Wilson, with, you know, even with Choosing Hats. Out of the four debates that I've personally done, one debate was with an atheist. That's it. I debated a Roman Catholic on Sola Scriptura, and I tried to do that in an explicitly presuppositional way. I would probably do it a little differently today if I did it again, but, you know, I was trying to be explicitly presuppositional in doing so. I debated a Muslim on the nature of the Bible and of the Quran. And I tried to do that in an explicitly presuppositional way as well. And I debated an annihilationist named Chris Date, who claims to be Reformed, but, you know, it's kind of hard to claim to be Reformed if you go against the confessions of the Reformed faith. I mean, it's, call me crazy, but that has nothing to do with the Reformed faith historically. It has nothing to do with it at all. So, you know, and I consider annihilationism a heresy. I don't see how it could be otherwise. But, and I'll be honest with you, that wasn't a debate I wanted to do. You know, I can think of a lot of things that I would much rather do than debate the topic of annihilationism. It would be a lot more fun, a lot more interesting to debate just about anything. Compared to annihilationism, but I did it because I thought that it would be valuable, to be perfectly honest with you. So that's what I did. And as a result, because I went out of my comfort zone, I actually found out that there's not a whole lot of Reformed response to annihilationism. There really isn't. So if you want something to work on, I'd be more than happy to give you all the information that I have on the topic. There are folks like Glenn Peoples, like David Smart, I believe is his name, also known as Rift, who is a contributor along with Chris Date and Glenn Peoples to the Rethinking Hell blog, which is basically a clearinghouse for the gospel of annihilationism. One of those one-string fiddle type groups that, you know, basically turn their whole ministerial energy toward one particular set of oddities, shall we say. So, you know, basically that's what I would like to encourage you to do. Again, I'm not saying to just drop atheism entirely. What I'm saying is it might be more beneficial to the church for you to go seek out areas in which you don't know anything right now. Because let's be honest, we're not all experts on every subject under the sun. Even Dr. White will tell you if you ask him about eschatology, if you ask him about the Eastern Orthodox, he's going to tell you it's not my area. So just a few off the top of my head, there's very little information from a Reformed perspective on is a specifically presuppositional response to I'm probably going to get in trouble here, but dispensationalism, as opposed to the historic Reformed view of covenantal theology, of federal theology. And I know there's going to be a whole big hue and cry about, oh, I can't believe you're talking about dispensationalism. Guys, where I learned precept is from Van Til. And I'm a Reformed Baptist, which means I am, by definition, covenantal. So, as a covenantal apologist, I'm talking about a not dispensational approach and an approach that is in accord with my theology. You'll hear the same thing from James White, and you'll hear the same thing from any Presbyterian. And Reform doesn't go all that past covenantal, Calvinistic, and confessional. I know the dispensationalists, well, we're Calvinistic. Okay, but can you subscribe to the 1689 London Baptist Confession? Well, no. Okay, what confession do you have? I don't see which one of the historic confessions that you could subscribe to. I don't see dispensational Presbyterians lining up all over the place. So, call me crazy, but what are you going to do with that? What are you going to do? But again, that's just one of the areas where it might be helpful to take that to the presuppositional method. Because again, we have this idea that it only works against atheism. Well, Van Til didn't think so. So why do you? Against Roman Catholicism. There's only one person I know of that deals with Roman Catholicism from a presuppositional standpoint, and that's Dr. James White. And he doesn't do a whole lot of Roman Catholic stuff anymore. He's mostly focused on Islam these days. But he put out a whole lot of material on the subject. So I encourage you, go look into that stuff. It's good work. Another suggestion, because this is something that practically nobody's dealt with, is the Eastern Orthodox. And this might be an especial challenge for you, because I personally know quite a few folks from the one or the other of the Westminsters that, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't think they ever really were, how can I put it, exactly on board with the whole confessional deal or the actual covenantal theology deal. So when they went looking, well, they knew Rome was bad. So when they went looking for something, you know, just a little more historical, or, you know, that whole full scriptura deal, well, after reading Barth, I don't know if I can deal with all that. So where do they end up? The Eastern Orthodox Church. I know several folks who come from a background similar to that of many Westminster students, but who never really bought into the program. But they know what precept is. So I'm going to tell you right now, I've dealt with a few of them. I know a little bit about the subject. I haven't dealt with it on Choosing Hats, but I've dealt with it personally in our chat channel and in other chat channels. You might find that quite a bit of a challenge for a number of reasons. So that might be something to look into. If you have a large Eastern Orthodox population near you, might be something to look into. You know, and of course, you know, if you live in certain parts of the country, every time I go past Toledo, Ohio, I see a ginormous mosque sitting right off the highway, and it's just huge. I mean, you could miss it if you wanted to. He's got some gigantic gold-tipped minarets and just a whole bunch of stuff like that. And it's ginormous. It's as big as any church that I've seen up here. So if you're in the Toledo, Ohio area, I know there's some Muslims around. And if you're in the Columbus area, of course, you know that there's that, you know, gigantic jihadi training center that the Canners went to growing up, of course, because, you know, everybody knows that they were trained in jihad. I'm kidding, of course. But there are Muslims in Ohio, quite a few of them. There's a bunch of Muslims in Dearborn, Michigan. So if you live where there are quite a bit of Muslims, if you live in the American Southwest where there's quite a bit of Roman Catholics, you might want to look into how to deal with Roman Catholicism, because it's obviously quite popular down there. So that's pretty much all I had to say. I mean, it's quite obvious that we have the tool set to deal with atheism. Whatever the atheists want to say, between all of the work that Van Til, that Bahnsen, that folks like Dr. White, Dr. Butler, James Anderson, and, you know, even folks like Paul Manada, Steve Hayes, there is a plethora of individuals who have dealt with atheism, and especially the modern internet atheism. We have sort of a running joke in channel that the methodology of internet atheism is to assert assertions assertively, the dreaded AAA. And, you know, I think every single one of Chris's debates have been with atheists. I've tried to do something other than atheism, mostly because we've just dealt so much with atheism. And I've always thought that it would be more valuable to do different things, to show that this isn't a just atheism methodology. If you would like to be of greater value to the church and to your local community, look into what is around you in your community. If you live around a whole bunch of Jews, how many presuppositionalist Jews for Jesus are there? Just throwing that out there. Do you know how to deal with Judaism presuppositionally? I'm going to tell you right now, I don't know that well. But that is something I would like to get into, because that would be very fun. How would you argue transcendentally against a Muslim? Because remember, the whole Christianity objection was supposed to be a pseudo-Islam, to say, well, how do you deal with Islam that has a transcendent God as well? How would you argue presuppositionally versus a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness or a Oneness Pentecostal? How would you do it? Do you even know? It'd be nice to find out, wouldn't it? Or to develop the argumentation so that others can use it as well. Because think about it, folks. The arguments for these things all begin when Christianity is challenged. The history of the apologetic task, if you look at how the doctrine of the Trinity was solidified in the creeds of Christendom, shall we say. It wasn't because the Pope said so. It wasn't because we all decided that the Trinity was the winner after Nicaea. No, it was because when Arius said there was a time when the sun was not, Athanasius said, oh no. Oh no, Scripture says different. And the response of Chalcedon about the hypostatic union was a response to an apologetic challenge as well. The responses from many early church fathers to folks like Marcion or the other Gnostic writers solidified the Christian doctrines of the canon, especially with Marcion and with the interesting claims by the Gnostics concerning the humanity of Christ. So the best way that the apologetic community can serve the church, the best way that the apologetic community can serve the church is to take the objections to the Christian faith from all of these different directions. And in the history of the church, how did we always serve the church? The elders and teachers of the church served the church by responding from the Scriptures to those who challenged what the Scripture said. That was Augustine's contribution in the Pelagian controversy. That was Athanasius' contribution in the Arian controversy. And we don't always see those results right now. We might not see any results until after we're dead and gone. In fact, I bet Van Til probably wasn't feeling all that satisfied with the spread of his ideas by the time he died. But there's been a recent resurgence of the presuppositional methodology far after Van Til's death and after Bahnsen's death. So if we are to reform the apologetics of the church, if we are to practice Semper Reformanda in the apologetic sphere, if we are to rid the Reformation churches of the last vestiges of the Roman Catholic classicalists and the Armenian evidentialist systems of apologetics, well, we have to go into all these fields where there's pretty much only evidentialists and only classicalists to respond to these folks, and we need to, as Paul said, show them a better way. A way that argues from the Scriptures and not from autonomous reasoning or from brute facts. We need to argue from the Scriptures. If we want to serve the church, we have to serve the church in more areas than just one. And I think the most value can be seen, because I think we've already demonstrated the value of the presuppositional approach against atheism. Even the evidentialists and classicalists, for the most part, see that when we argue with the atheist, we can take them apart from the Scriptures. And they see the value in that, but we can't buy into their idea that, well, you know, that might be good there, but it's not going to be any good over here. Well, says who? Not Van Til. Because to Van Til, Christian theism is a unit. What is non-Christian theism? A unit. Does it matter what kind? No. Because all instances of non-Christian theism, all specific denials, are a failure at one particular point or another to be consistent with Christian theism. It's a denial of Christian theism at point A, or point B, or point C, or point D in Christian theism, and it's a twisting. Because remember, sin is a corruption of perfection. It's a lack of somewhere. As Romans 1 says, it's an exchange of the truth for a lie. Where that truth is exchanged depends on where the lie is introduced and which aspect of the truth is exchanged. All Christian theism is a unit. All non-Christian theism is a unit. And all deformations that we would still say are within Christian theism, but are significant errors, such as dispensationalism, or I would say the continuationists, or the folks who deny sola scriptura, Arminianism. All of these areas, why can't we respond to them presuppositionally, folks? Why not? If we can respond to Roman Catholics presuppositionally, and I think I've demonstrated that we can, in fact, do so, and I'm just following Van Til there. If we can respond to them presuppositionally, we should be able to respond to any issue which touches on faith and practice, which is all of life. We're Reformed, after all. Since we can respond to any issue, why don't we? Especially with religions like Islam or Mormonism or Jehovah's Witnesses, which are all explicit in borrowing from Christianity. They explicitly do so. Now, Islam wants to back away from that. Now, Mormonism can't decide what it wants to do. And Jehovah's Witnesses, well, they try and use our Bible, but it's not quite our Bible, is it? So, how can we provide the most value to the church? By growing past atheism, folks. We know how to deal with atheism. We have books and books and reams and debates about atheism. Now, what else can you do? Because the defense and confirmation of the gospel is not solely to the atheist. It's to anyone who asks us a reason for the hope that is within us. Now, you might not know exactly how to deal with a Muslim, because you might only meet one Muslim in your life. Let's be honest. But if God has placed you in an area where there's plenty of a particular religious group, or a particular group that revels in one social evil, say, or one moral evil, I should say, if you're in San Francisco, you probably need to know how to deal with homosexuality. If you live near an abortion clinic, you probably need to know how to argue about abortion. So, think it over. How can you serve the church and offer the most value? How can you use your gifts for the glory of God? Is it by beating up on college town atheists, or is it by dealing with the Jehovah's Witness, the Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall right around the corner from you? You know, those nice young men that knock on the door, those smartly dressed young men in the JCPenney, who just walked right out of the JCPenney catalog, riding their mountain bikes and carrying a Bible and a Book of Mormon. How can you most glorify God in the situation where God has placed you? That might be dealing with atheists. It might be. But if that's not where God has placed you, don't go looking for atheists when you have other folks in your backyard. Don't go looking for other folks if you have someone else in your backyard. This has been Joshua. This is another edition of Peripatetic, and I hope that has been helpful. Good night, and God bless.
ChoosingHats.com, dedicated to the explanation and demonstration of presuppositional apologetics in defense of the Christian faith for the glory of God.